In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with David Horowitz. He's the editor of the Jerusalem Report News Magazine. It's an English language magazine published in Israel. He's also a frequent contributor to newspapers around the world. He's the author of a recently published memoir about his experiences in Israel. The title is A Little Too Close to God, The Thrills and Panic of a Life in Israel. It's published by Knopf. He was born in Britain and moved to Israel in 1983 when he was 20 years old. Soon found a job there working at the Jerusalem Post while he was going to Hebrew University and stayed on. Continued to work for the magazine, now also has a family there, and writes about some of his experiences in this book. This book was published a little earlier this year and predates what has been going on within the last month or so, but we'll certainly ask him for some of his reflections on where the peace process stands now and what's going on there in Israel. And, of course, questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions brief so that we can make room for anybody who might like to call. You are sharing the space with others. Do keep that in mind. But anybody's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Locally, again, 333-WILL. That's what you get when you match the numbers and the letters. And toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Horowitz, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What led you to move to Israel when you did in 1983?
Oh, well, I went to a Jewish day school in London, and the school had like a policy. They would take each class to Israel for a couple of weeks when we were about 15. And if you've lived in London for any length of time, you'll know that it's a very nice place. It rains every other day. The first thing that struck me about going to Israel was that the weather was fantastic. That might sound a bit banal, but that was a big pull early on. And then there was this weird sense of somehow belonging, even though obviously I hadn't grown up there. I could read Hebrew, but I couldn't really speak it. I sensed a sort of kinship with people there that I felt could be deepened. And very early on, I went with this trip, and then I kept going back every year or so for a week or two until I kind of finally made the decision to go for a longer time. You sense this kind of electric, addictive quality to the country because it's like, you know, they say on the websites, you know, under construction. It's still being resolved. Its shape is still being battled over, literally at the moment, unfortunately, but also in people's minds. And you have a sense that if you go there, you can really have an impact on the country, and that's a very attractive feeling.
Mm. It's been almost a month now. There has been violence there. 126 people have been killed, thousands injured, the vast majority in both cases Palestinians. I guess I still, as I read the stories and had a conversation about this with a political scientist who studies the Mideast a couple of weeks ago, I still find myself having a very difficult time understanding exactly what happened, or perhaps better the question, why. Certainly there was tension, certainly things were not perfect, but how is it that things managed to get so bad so fast?
Yeah, first of all, don't be surprised that you're having difficulty coming to terms with it, because I think everybody is. I don't think very many people saw this coming in this kind of dramatic way. I also think it's probably a little early to start drawing hard and fast conclusions, and I'm always amazed by the certainties with which people talk, you know, the absolute certainty that they have when they give their explanations. But I have the sense that the opportunity went begging, really, in July. If you remember, in July, Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak came out to the States, and President Clinton basically locked them away at Camp David for 2 weeks and tried to pressure them into signing a permanent peace treaty. And I think they'd made phenomenal progress over recent years. I think many of the aspects of that final deal were pretty close to being agreed. But then everything came up against the dispute over what the Jews called the Temple Mount and the Muslims called Haram al-Sharif, the center of the old city of Jerusalem, where Israel has wanted to maintain full sovereignty and where the Palestinians have wanted to achieve full sovereignty. Now, I'm not talking about East and West Jerusalem. I'm talking about the center of the old city. And they, neither side, I don't think, was prepared to compromise completely. But as far as I can see, the Israeli government, the Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, was prepared to begin discussing proposals for compromise over the Temple Mount, and he was willing to share Jerusalem. Now, this, of course, was strain, to put it mildly, of the Israeli consensus. I'm not sure that the majority of Israelis would have backed a deal like that, but he was talking in those terms, and from what I can understand, Yasser Arafat was not. He wasn't willing to make the compromise that would have made that deal work. Now, of course, he had his own considerations, one of which I would imagine is he probably feared that somebody would kill him. And we've seen the Israeli Prime Minister 5 years ago, just about now, Yitzhak Rabin, was assassinated by one of his own people who opposed the compromises that he was making. This is a high-risk business. But I think that's where it fell apart. I think there was an unwillingness to compromise on the Palestinian side. And again, if you had a Palestinian interviewee on this show, I'm sure he would explain either why that wasn't the case or why that was the case. I can only give you my point of view.
Mm-hmm, certainly. And thinking back on this, and I mentioned this in this other interview that I had a couple of weeks ago, and going back and looking at some of the newspaper accounts, at around the time that Mr. Sharon made his visit to the Temple Mount, I was certainly very struck by the stories that had appeared a day or two before, talking about a meeting that had taken place between Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak at Mr. Barak's house. Mr. Arafat came to his house, which is unusual to start with, and this was described as the best meeting these two men had ever had. Now we went from a month ago, the best meeting they'd ever had, to them not speaking to one another, to them hurling insults at one another. I guess I'm just, again, I find it difficult to know how one goes from the best meeting you've ever had to where they are now in the space of a month.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It is extraordinary that just days before all this extraordinary violence broke out and this descent, as you said, into name-calling as well as combat, just days before, they were, as you say, Mr. Arafat was around at Mr. Barak's house, and that was a very unusual event, to put it mildly. That's not the kind of thing that was happening all the time. The Palestinian claim is that Mr. Barak has been pursuing what they call an exit strategy, that he kind of set up this visit for Ariel Sharon, knowing that it would trigger unrest and then we'd get into this horrifying violence. And I just don't buy that at all. I'm not sure that Mr. Arafat initiated everything that's happened in the last month, although there are plenty of Israeli commentators who believe that he has. I'm not sure that he has, but I think it's relieved him of the need to make this tremendously dramatic decision, and I think that with every day that the fighting goes on, the likelihood of anyone asking him to make any kind of compromise decisions now is receding. I mean, talk of compromise is really not on the table at all now. At the moment, things are deteriorating. I think the real fear on the Israeli side now is that these things may ripple further afield. And in fact, the crumbs of comfort from the last few days came from the Arab summit at the weekend. When you have the sense that some of the more hardline Arab states were looking to widen this conflict and that saner voices prevailed, notably those of King Abdullah of Jordan and President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, which makes us think tentatively that at least perhaps this can be contained and eventually we can stop the bullets flying in both directions altogether.
Mm. Well, certainly it seems clear that Mr. Sharon had his reasons for what he did, and that it seems to have a good deal to do with his attempt to take over, that he's likely to be challenged for leadership of Likud by Mr. Netanyahu, and that this public display was intended to show just how tough he's prepared to be on these issues. And perhaps such a thing would have not been politically possible at the time, but one wonders whether anyone had said to him, you know, this is probably not such a good idea for you to do this.
Well, the Prime Minister absolutely had the right to cite security considerations and say we'd rather you not go, because let's be honest about this, Ariel Sharon walking around on the Temple Mount is not the same as you or I or any of the other millions of visitors doing it, and there was a huge security detail. So he could have stopped it, and I rather believe he rather wishes that he had. But his security people plainly told him that this was not going to be a particularly problematic visit and that it would not set off the kind of violence that it has turned out to set off. The tragedy, though, I mean, again, coming to the sort of objection from the Palestinian side to Sharon's visit, Sharon symbolizes many things for much of the Arab world. He is probably the most reviled Israeli politician. But he is the leader of the opposition in Israel, and this is the irony and the tragedy. His are the policies that a strong majority of the Israeli electorate rejected last year. I mean, Barak was elected to office by a 56-44% margin because he was going to try and make peace. Now, if Mr. Sharon had been the prime minister and he'd gone up and done very provocative things like saying, oh, let's knock down the mosques, well, one could understand a hysterical reaction. But A, he's the leader of the opposition, and B, he went and then he went up and then he went down again. Had saner voices prevailed, it could have been an unremarkable visit. I'm not saying that all the blame for everything that has unfolded attaches to the Palestinian side. I wonder if Israeli police could have handled the next day's clashes more sensitively. Mm. And I'm sure that they may be feeling that as well. But this was an opposition leader. This was a man who opposed the policies of the prime minister and who now, a month down the line, is set to join Mr. Barak's government, because otherwise Mr. Barak is going to fall from power. It's a tragic deterioration. Mm.
Just to take one point further, just a bit, and then we have some callers, and certainly we'll give people a chance to ask questions. Some people have said that they feel that the response of the Israeli government to that, well, Mr. Sharon went. No surprise that this would invite an angry response to his visit from Palestinians, which then invited an even larger response from the Israeli government. And some people have said perhaps that was another opportunity intensity could have been stepped down rather than stepped up, and that it was an over response. It was more than it needed to be. What's your thought about them?
What I said to you just a couple of minutes ago kind of reflects my thinking on that. The week after, I mean, on the Thursday, Mr. Sharon went up. On the Friday, there was the first loss of life on Temple Mount after Muslim prayers, when there were a large number of Palestinian worshippers up there on the Temple Mount. I think they charged at the police. The police fired back, and I think 7 people were killed. The week later, the police deployed outside the compound atop the Temple Mount there. And there was some violence outside the Temple Mount area, but there was no violence on the mount itself. They were heavily criticized by the Israeli right wing for abandoning the mount a week later. But perhaps somewhere between the two, of the very heavy presence of the week before and the no presence at all a week later, there was room for some more sensitive policing. But I'm not a policeman. I'm not a police chief, and I'm sure they would argue that they did things the way they thought they were best able to do them. But I think the other criticism is kind of a wider criticism that you're making, which is a criticism that we've heard echoed at the UN, which talks of Israel in an exaggerated response to some of this violence. And again, I'm not a soldier standing at a military outpost in the West Bank, but the Palestinian argument has been that they do not have an army, and Israel is shooting youths armed only with stones and petrol bombs. Well, the truth is that most of the people who are demonstrating may be throwing stones and petrol bombs, which can do damage of themselves, but there have also been people firing from within the demonstrations. In other words, there have been gunmen in those ranks of people, and that's why the Israeli army says it has been returning fire. And then there are the people who say, well, look at the casualty figures, and you see 100 and something Palestinians dead, 114, or the numbers are moving all the time, sadly, and only 8 or so Israeli Jews who've been killed, as if there had been more Israelis killed, that might somehow be better. The truth is that nobody should be dying here. The truth is that President Clinton went out to Sharm el-Sheikh a few days ago and thought he had agreed with both sides that they would publicly declare an effort to end the violence, and I certainly heard the Israeli Prime Minister making such a declaration, and I know that the Palestinian leadership had a statement read out on Palestinian television, but I also know what else is being shown on Palestinian television, and I don't think that there is an equal effort by both sides to stop this. And I think if there was, I think if the Palestinians were definitely seriously trying to stop this, it would stop, instead of which you hear Palestinian ministers talking about this being the war for Palestinian national independence. But there didn't need to be a war. There was a partnership, and there was an Israeli government that was ready to work with Yasser Arafat towards Palestinian independence.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with David Horovitz. He's editor of the Jerusalem Report News Magazine. It is an English language publication published in Israel. He's also a frequent contributor to newspapers around the world. He was born in England, but then in 1983 settled in Israel. And he's the author of a book about his experiences living there, which is titled A Little Too Close to God, The Thrills and Panic of a Life in Israel, that came out earlier this year, published by Knopf. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have several callers here. Let's start with Freeport, line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, good morning.
Yes?
I've read a book on the history of Jerusalem. It states that in 1900 there were only 5,000 Jews living in Jerusalem. Then we have the development of political Zionism. And, you know, it's just like the white settlers came to this country and dispossessed the Indians, and, you know, there was resistance. The Indians fought back against taking their land, and it ought to be realized that when you come and try and kick people off their land, you know, there's going to be resistance, and this is the key factor. It has to be faced by Israel. If there could be some restoration of land or compensation to the Arabs, you know. Otherwise, I'm afraid this violence will go on, maybe even escalate.
Well, Mr. Horvitz, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the point is well made, but there are two factors that I'd say that the Jewish connection to Jerusalem may have dulled at the turn of the century, but the Jewish connection to Jerusalem goes back thousands of years, and there has been a return to Jerusalem rather than a discovery of Jerusalem by the Jews. But the second part of your point is the key, that there has to be compromise. The United Nations, the international community, partitioned the area a little over 50 years ago. There was a division, the idea being that Jews and Arabs would live peacefully side by side. It didn't work out that way for the first few decades of modern Israel's existence. But in the last 7 years, since this Oslo peace process was started in 1993, there was an effort by the leadership on both sides to do exactly what you're saying, which is to compromise and compensate and divide and share in a way that would be as equitable as possible, in which presumably neither side would be completely delighted with the results, but each side would be able to live with the results. And that's what it seemed that we were on the point of achieving just a few weeks ago. The Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, was talking. We've never heard a kind of official take on this, but at Camp David, we understand, he talked about relinquishing something in excess of 90% of the West Bank. Remember, a large proportion or a certain proportion of the West Bank has been relinquished under the Oslo process in recent years. So there was going to be this pullback from most of the West Bank, and he was ready to share Jerusalem. I mean, he was ready to do exactly what you're rightly saying needed to be done, which is to find a compromise solution. And again, when all this violence is over and, you know, may it end today, the sides will have to sit down again sooner or later. Now, there are plenty of people on both sides who don't see this, who think that, it'll have to be settled by violence, or that it can never be settled, or that one side will have to impose its will on the other. But I think most people on both sides believe that sooner or later they're going to have to sit down again and try and negotiate some kind of compromise. And it is just tragic that people are dying and that there has to be more bloodshed before they get back again to sitting down face-to-face and trying to find an equitable solution. Hmm.
Let's go on to another call. This is Belgium, line number 1. Hello?
Yes. To start off with, I have numerous discussions with friends about this, and we can't agree to it, and we're a long ways from the problem. I don't know how in the world you folks there in the problem are ever going to agree to it. But to get to the question I have, which I think is you can uniquely answer, is that I know the problem's gone on for millennia. I know for the last 50 years it's been a modern problem. But it seems to me that at the demise of the Soviet Republic, you had a large influx of immigrants into Israel. And that same group of immigrants are also the ones that are very strongly on the right, which also seem to be some of the people who are causing most of the problems, and going into Hebron right in the middle of the conflict a couple of weeks ago and just stirring it all the more. And it seems to me you've imported your own problem. Could I hear your comments on that, please?
Yeah, first of all, it's a relief to me to hear that, you know, you guys are talking about it here and also having trouble trying to find out where right and wrong is and where black and white is and what the solutions should be. There's a great temptation, I think, to simplify and to be certain that, oh, my goodness, that's exactly what they should be doing, or, oh, that's really, it's obvious that they shouldn't be doing that. But the truth is, it is all much more gray than we would like it to be. And one of the things I write about in my book is members of my own family. I live in Jerusalem, and some members of my own family live in a settlement in the West Bank. And I have been a champion of efforts at reconciliation, and they have been very cynical and skeptical about the prospects of those efforts succeeding. And we've argued a fair bit. So the arguments, never mind arguing thousands of miles away, we argue pretty deeply right there. We argue within the same families. Now, with reference to the Russians, you're right, there has been an influx of about 1 million Russian immigrants in the last decade into Israel. Once the Soviet Union collapsed and the exit gates were opened. But to characterize the Russians as the troublemakers or the extremists, it's not correct. I mean, obviously one has to generalize, but the Russians as a mass have been like a swing voting sector. In other words, if you think of the American election campaign, which I know most people are thinking about a great deal these days, and kind of who are the key blocks of voters that need to be swung one way or the other, where in Israel the political system is such that the Russian immigrants have been the making and breaking of governments the last decade. They helped Yitzhak Rabin come to power in 1992. They helped Benjamin Netanyahu unseat the moderates in 1996. And last year, they swung back towards the moderate Labour Party candidate, Ehud Barak, and they helped him get elected. So I'm sure that the political arguments among Russian immigrants rage as vehemently as they rage among people here and among every other Israeli. But they're certainly not. It would be wrong to characterize them as a stridently right-wing extremist group. It's not the case.
Well, I didn't mean each and every one of them, sir. I meant they do make the populace larger. They do put pressure to move more into the settlements, is what I was meaning.
I would say that there are some people from the Russian community who have become fairly outspoken on the right. I don't think I take your point. I didn't understand you correctly, perhaps. And there are people from the Russian immigrant community who have been outspoken champions of compromise as well. There have also been there's a fair amount of American immigrants among the West Bank settlers, and
there's
a perception that they're all Americans, which is also a misconception. It's often that the CBS or CNN, they go out into the settlements and they say, well, who speaks English? So, of course, the Americans pipe up, and the majority who are not English-speaking, therefore, don't come across too often on television here.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Well, what I think that raising this very question points at one of the great challenges, I'm certain, of life in Israel and Israeli politics, and that is, how does one accommodate the enormous diversity that you find there? Because you have Israelis and Arabs, you have people who are religious and who are not religious, and within the religious community you have people who are liberal and people who are ultra-Orthodox. You have American Jews and Russian Jews, and you have Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews, and so many different groups of people with different points of view. How do you make politics work given that reality?
Well, yeah, you've pinpointed a pretty acute problem there. And until a few weeks ago, in fact, we were tempted to believe that we had reached the stage, or we were nearing the stage, where we would have the luxury of being able to address those kinds of internal and domestic difficulties rather than, as is again the case and has been the case, trying to address relations with the Arab world and with the Palestinians. But if we ever, and may we soon, find our way of reconciliation with the Arab world and with the Palestinians, then yes, we have this tremendous internal splintering, sectoralization. In terms of Israeli politics, I'll tell you, in the last elections last year, there's only 120 seats in the parliament. There were 30-something political parties running for office, and about half of them made it. So you have your Russian immigrant parties, not just one, heaven forbid, you've got a couple of them, and you have your Israeli Arab parties. You have about three of them, representatives of Israel's million-strong Arab community. And you have your left-wing and your right-wing parties. And you had parties that didn't actually make it into the Knesset this time, into the parliament this time. who are campaigning on things like better rights for taxi drivers and legalized marijuana and all sorts of other things. But you do, you have this tremendous sectoralization, and you have small groups who are campaigning for their own interests, and it makes the country very hard to govern. I mean, I mentioned that Mr. Barak came to power last year with quite a strong personal majority. The way the system works, he was directly elected prime minister by about a 12% margin. But then he had to put together a governing coalition in the parliament, and he needed to bring about six or seven parties into that coalition with him. And his troubles at the moment are that most of those parties have now bolted. He's now the head of a minority coalition, and again, he's trying to rapidly rebuild a governing majority. Otherwise, when Parliament reconvenes in a few days' time, he's going to find himself possibly voted out of office and having to prepare for elections.
Let's take another caller here. This is Bloomington, Indiana, line two. Hello.
Hi. Could I ask Mr. Horwitz to comment on the present situation in Israel in light of some history? Here's the history. In 1948, as soon as Israel was declared a state, as soon as Israel was born, all of the Muslim states surrounding Israel attacked Israel. They tried to destroy Israel at its birth. That's one part of the history. Then, again, prior to the 1967 war, that is, some people call that the Six-Day War, the Muslims at that time, they owned part of Jerusalem. They owned the entire West Bank. In other words, they owned everything that they are now demanding, and they attacked Israel anyway. Okay, in the light of that kind of past history, in the light of that history, why would anyone expect the Muslims to be satisfied with anything other than the complete destruction of the Jewish state now?
Well, I wouldn't quibble overly with your history. We certainly in Israel had wars imposed. I think that would be the way most Israeli would see it. On us in the early years of the state. I think historically you're right to say that the territory that Israel has been negotiating with the Palestinians in the last few years was territory that until 1967, you're quite right, Israel didn't actually hold. Old city of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Desert, the Golan Heights, this was all territory that wasn't Israeli held prior to the 1967 war, and yet we found ourselves in a war that year. But the question is, what do you do with the reality now? The reality now is that we have a country in Israel of 6 million people. We have, of those, about a million of them, like I said, are Israeli Arabs. We have about 2 or 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Israel, most people in the country would say, does not want to extend its sovereignty throughout the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. In other words, to make the Jewish nature of the country much less the case, much less dominant. In other words, if we were to do that, if we were to say, okay, this is the territory we captured in 1967, we've given the Sinai back to Egypt and we have a peace treaty with them, we've tried to negotiate with Syria over the Golan Heights, but were we to extend sovereignty to the West Bank and Gaza, we would only just be a Jewish majority in that territory, and we would have millions of people within our expanded country who were offended, to put it very mildly, at the notion of falling under Israeli rule. We would just make our problems all the more acute. So what we have tried to do, we've tried to find a way to separate, to divide the land. And were we to have reached a peace treaty, and are we in the future to reach a peace treaty, nobody in Israel would seriously say, oh, okay, Arab dreams in some Arab hearts of further territorial gains from Israel may not necessarily disappear. Nobody would say in Israel, well, let's disband the army. We've made peace now. Everything's going to be hunky-dory. I don't think people are that naive. But they would say, let's try and find a reconciliation. Let's try and divide the territory up in a way that both sides can live with. Let's hopefully receive the blessings of the international community, and then let us protect our country, as any country would, safely from within its internationally agreed borders.
To what degree do you think the events of the last month damaged relationships between the government of Israel and its neighbors?
I think again, it's early to draw even the sort of apparently very easy to draw conclusions. I mean, the rhetoric that came out of the Arab summit at the weekend was extremely hostile to Israel. And if one were to judge merely by what was said in the various speeches at that summit, you would say, well, this has been a terrible blow to relations between Israel and obviously, never mind the Iraqis and the Libyans and countries like that never have sought anything other than Israel's destruction, but you know, listen to what's being said by the Egyptians and the Jordanians, with whom we have peace treaties. But the truth is that at that summit, those Arab nations, especially the Egyptians and the Jordanians, from what we can understand, blocked efforts by some of the more hostile states who were pressing for Egypt and Jordan to sever relations with Israel. I mean, Egypt hasn't withdrawn its ambassador, nor have the Jordanians. And in both of their countries, they have had demonstrations that must be worrying their regimes by Islamic students and by people opposed to their relations with Israel. So I don't think that those relationships are damaged beyond repair, certainly not at the moment, although I think, like I say, it's foolish to get too carried away as to what may unfold. Where I think that the real terrible damage has been done is between Israelis and Palestinians at a leadership level and at a man in the street level. I've given you, obviously, the take from the Israeli side of the street, where I think most Israelis feel that the Sharon visit was seized upon by Yasser Arafat or by other people within the Palestinian leadership as a pretext to get into this conflict. On the Palestinian side, one has to say the Palestinian people, I'm not sure if the leadership truly believe what they're saying, but the Palestinian people, I have no doubt, are convinced that this was deliberately planned by Israel and that the Israeli government was not serious about seeking peace. And that is the tragedy. I had a conversation with a Palestinian journalist in a radio phone in two weeks ago, when I was in Jerusalem. And she talked about how all the mothers in Gaza are ready to sacrifice their daughters for Palestine. And I said to her, well, why would they do that? Why would they not rather come around and play with my sons? Come around to play. Hmm. Why would they want to kill themselves? She said, because there's been no hope of peace. There has been no chance of statehood. There has been no possibility of compromise. And I said to her, but that's not true. There has been a government in Israel that has been trying to work with the Palestinians towards statehood. And I don't think this message percolated through to the Palestinian people. And that, I think, is a failure of the Palestinian leadership.
We are at the point here where we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with David Horvitz. He's editor of the Jerusalem Report news magazine. It's an English language publication published in Israel. He also has contributed to newspapers around the world. He's the author of a memoir of his experiences living in Israel. The title of his book is A Little Too Close to God, The Thrills and Panic of a Life in Israel, published by Knopf. It came out earlier this year. And if you have questions, we'd certainly welcome them. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll continue here. We have a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Uh-huh. I just thought I'd call and say I've been reading the forum from the Independent newspaper in London recently. Some of the stuff that's been written there seems to indicate we're not getting too much of the information from the Palestinian side here. Quite a few things have come up in that forum which don't, you know, penetrate our wall on this side of the Atlantic, I don't pay much attention to. I hadn't paid much attention to the Middle East, but the killing of that kid at the wall with his father was just unbelievable. And the way you dismiss Israeli actions as being justified because you think, and I'm quite sure that it's totally bogus, that there's firing from within the rioting group. I mean, when Amnesty International, right out of London, accuses Israelis of excessive force, the UN accuses Israelis of excessive force. I mean, it's just silly. And people who just take that assertion without any looking into it are really guilty of assisting you.
Well, let's hear what Mr. Horvitz has to say.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that you prefaced your remarks by saying you haven't been taking much of an interest, and then you expressed with such certainty that the adamant Israeli claim that there are gunmen firing from within the ranks of the demonstrators is manifestly false. Well, it's not false. That is the reality. The bullets are flying in both directions. There's no question that there's an imbalance of power here. The Israeli army is considerably more powerful. And the image that you cited of Muhammad al-Dira being killed by that wall in Gaza is one of the two most abiding images of this conflict. And the conflict is very much fought out at the level of images. The other image, of course, is the two Israeli soldiers being murdered in Ramallah a week after that. As I said earlier, though, and I certainly don't dismiss, by the way, something else you said, play off or minimize the awfulness of the casualties on the Palestinian side. What I say is two things. Would it be better if more Israelis were dying? Well, of course it wouldn't. Would it be better if nobody was dying? Absolutely. Do I believe that this Israeli government was trying to find a compromise with the Palestinians that would involve nobody else dying? Yes, I absolutely do, and that is the tragedy of what's happening now. What's happening now is futile, it's unnecessary, it could have been avoided, and when it stops, we will have to go back to where we were before, which is trying to find some kind of accommodation.
Well, my comment had to do with excess force, and I just want to bring up two things that were brought up in the Independence Forum, which were not countered by the many people writing in that forum, and one was that the van where those two soldiers, or those soldiers in Ramallah, were driving was full of explosives, and also that there was just recently a killing by Israeli settlers where they tortured a Palestinian and set him afire and killed him while he was still alive by setting him afire. Anyway.
No, please, don't say that. Let me respond to both of those points, because there's a great deal of disinformation going around here, and there is a great deal of confusion going around here. The person who was allegedly tortured by settlers, as far as the Israeli official version is concerned, was somebody who was killed in a car accident. There has been violence between settlers and Palestinians. There have been two settlers killed by Palestinians. The rumor of the car being filled with explosives of the two gentlemen, the two Israeli soldiers who were killed in Ramallah, goes along with the other very widely held assertion on the Palestinian side that these people were not, in fact, Israeli soldiers in the reserves who had been called up for reserve duty, but that they were, in fact, undercover soldiers who had snuck into Ramallah, bent on I don't know what exactly. The two people who were killed were men in their 30s. They were wearing uniforms. They were not undercover commandos who had entered Ramallah undercover, bent on I don't know what. Now there are, I would imagine, there are things that I believe to be the case about aspects of this conflict that may not be the case. I think, again, I'm always staggered by the certainty with which people talk about things, especially things that are often very unclear. Even such basic things as whether Yasser Arafat released this or that Hamas Islamic militant from jail in the last few days, or whether he's been putting these people back into jail. There is information that is very, very hard to pin down. But at the bottom line of all these clashes is the tragedy of them, the fact that they could have been avoided, and the need for them to stop, because eventually we're going to have to sit down and talk again.
Hmm. Let's continue. We'll go to another caller, Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Okay. I want to there are several points to your guest. The first one, he's saying Sharon had every right. Sharon is a secular Jew. If he was a Jewish, an observant Jew, he would not go on the Temple Mount. His visit was a provocation. When he goes around there with 3,000 soldiers in full riot gear, that's an outright provocation. The response to him was the people rioted. What is the treatment for rioters? To shoot live ammunition and metal bullets covered with rubber? What happened to tear gas? What I see from Israel's response to us, to the Palestinian, is a very racist attitude. And your guest also confirmed that to me. when he said, we don't want the West Bank and Gaza because that will decrease the Jewish character of Israel. Well, if you don't want to, if you want to do that, then follow the UN resolutions that tells you to withdraw from the occupied territories, which include all of the West Bank and Gaza, not just pockets. That's what they want to do to us. They want to give us pockets. They say Israel is willing and doing. What is it doing? Giving us, like, they want us to live like Indian here or Indian reservation. That's, Israel has a very racist attitude. You call it a democracy. Look how it's treating its own citizen. It's an apartheid system. Arab Israelis are not free to buy land anywhere in Israel itself. They have restrictions put on them. They're second-class citizens. Look how they treated the Flasha when they came to Israel. They were not even allowed to donate blood for fear of the... there's a difference between also Ashkenazi and Sephardim. When this attitude, when this racist attitude of Israel changes, then we'll change. He also accuses always Arafat is pushing all of this. We're not animals. We can decide for ourselves. Okay? People were not pushed by Arafat or his or the PA. And he knows that we were frustrated by the PA also. So this uprising is by the people, not by Arafat. Mm.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. Mr. Horvitz, you want to make some response?
Well, first of all, it is absolutely correct that most observant Jews would not set foot on the Temple Mount because the consensus among most rabbis in Israel is that this ground is too holy as the ground where the Jewish temple stood. Mr. Sharon is indeed not an observant Jew, so I can't argue with that. There were protests to his visit, and the police reacted. The protests, remember, when people run out of the mosques on Temple Mount and they throw stones, where they're throwing them over the wall is the Western Wall, is the holiest existing site
that
in Jerusalem, the site where below the Temple Mount there are, certainly on Fridays and lots of other times, a great number of observant Jews there praying, and the police are therefore defending them, among other things. We're as good a democracy as we can be, and we are certainly not a democracy without our problems. It is certainly the case that Israel's Arab citizens have received inadequate funding at local council level. The school systems aren't as good. There are lots of problems with that. They have equal voting rights. They are equal citizens, and the government and governments down the decades have moved too slowly, I would say, but tried to move towards a proper equalizing of the funding and the social policies and other aspects of Israeli-Arab life in Israel. You cite the Falasha, which is a reference to the Jews from Ethiopia, to whom Israel opened its gates mainly in the 70s, but also at the beginning of the 90s. And you cite that as a case of our treatment of them as a case of racism. I mean, it's quite the reverse. I mean, these were people who claimed to be Jewish and who sought to come and return to Israel, to their ancient homeland, as they saw it. And Israel sent planes and brought them out in 1991 at the height of the civil war in Addis Ababa. Over a single weekend, Israel airlifted 14,000 Ethiopian Jews to Israel and paid I don't know how many millions in bribes to the Ethiopian government of the day in order to be allowed to bring them out. And there was scientifically research that suggested that there was a greater risk of AIDS in the blood of Ethiopians, and therefore there were probably some fairly badly handled efforts to screen and to ensure that blood that might be infected not enter Israeli blood banks when people were giving blood. But I mean, I think Israel's opening of its doors to Ethiopian Jews is the absolute opposite of racism.
We just have about 2 minutes left. I hope the last caller will forgive me. The lines are full, and I would like to try to get at least one other person. People have been patient in holding on here. We have someone calling from a car phone, so they're next in line. This would be line 4. Hello?
Hello. The one point was made by the previous caller that I wanted to make, but I want to go back to the caller who said, why would the Israelis trust the Palestinians in terms of making an agreement with them? And I want to focus on Ariel Sharon and his provocative act. isn't it the case that Ariel Sharon refers to all of Judea and Samaria as legitimate territories of Israel, which would include all of the West Bank and parts of Syria? And for this person to go on the Temple Mount with the full knowledge and support of the government, why is there this shock that the people respond in the way that they did? It's quite obvious Arafat's support among the Palestinians is quite thin. He probably could not win an open election. And you keep repeating that Arafat seized on this when it looks to me like the Israelis were looking for a way out. It was quite predictable what would happen if the specific figure of Sharon went on the Temple Mount, and that they have seized on it as a way of stalling the peace process.
Yeah, we need to. We're very short on time, and need to again say thanks to the caller, Mr. Horovitz. I think in some sense you've responded to these questions, but give us a last thought.
Yeah, well, two quick thoughts. First of all, Mr. Arafat did win an open election. I'm not entirely sure that it was the most democratic election ever fought in the history of mankind, but it was an election. There was another candidate. She was a social worker from the Ramallah area, and he won about 90% of the vote. So he is the elected head of the Palestinian Authority, and he's definitely the person who most Palestinians would see as their leader. Many Jews around the world recognize areas far beyond the limits of today's Israeli sovereignty as having been part of the biblical land of Israel. That does not mean that all of those Jews believe that Israel should expand its sovereignty to those areas. The peace process was about finding a compromise. And again, I didn't really respond directly to the previous caller who talked about making the Palestinians live as Indians. At the moment, the Palestinians have full control, indeed, of the main big cities in the West Bank. The peace process is designed to give the Palestinians full control. It would have brought them full control of in excess of 90% of the West Bank if this deal had come to pass at Camp David 3 months ago. I've tried, obviously I'm speaking from an Israeli point of view, but I have tried not to be completely deaf to what the sense of what is coming out of the Palestinian side. And at bottom, and if I've said this four or five times already, I apologize, at bottom, again, sooner or later, the two sides are going to have to sit down together and find an equitable way out of this that gives both peoples their independence and their security.
We will have to leave it at that, with the promise that I'm sure we'll be discussing this again on future programs. Our guest, David Horovitz, is editor of the Jerusalem Report News magazine. Mr. Horovitz, thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Thank you, David.